This episode is brought to you by Baby Audio, maker of creative plugin effects and instruments for music production and mixing. Baby Audio plugins are all about adding character to your mix, from stylish heavy compression with iHeart New York 2 to radical vocal processing with their latest release, Humanoid. Go to mixingmusicpodcast.com/babyaudio to learn more and take 15% off any order with the code MIXINGMUSIC. Hello and welcome back to the Mixing Music Podcast. I'm your host DK, and with me today is a special guest. He is a mixer currently based in Miami, but potentially moving to Los Angeles in a few months. Has worked on, not only is this guy multi-platinum diamond engineer, but he has a Guinness World Record. What is the record for the most streamed song within a 24-hour period? And it was Triple X song "Sad." This guy has a very wide range of songs under his belt. And today we're going to talk to Cohen Heldens about mixing. And specifically, I've asked him if we can speak on his expertise on mixing remotely, which is something that you do quite often. Is that right, Cohen?
Totally correct, yes. Especially with the nowadays industry, you know, because it's I think during the pandemic, a lot of people, because they couldn't enter offices, you couldn't really go to studios. So I think we got kind of adapt to the more isolated life of, hey, you know what, we can do this remote. And then you have, you know, companies like Audio Movers that make it simple to stream the session in, you know, high quality, in a high quality stream, I need to say. And then I always jump on FaceTime, like, okay, let's at least put a personal touch in here. So yeah, remote mixing has become a big part of my daily life nowadays.
That is incredible. So first off, welcome to the Mixing Music Podcast. Thanks for being here and taking the time to be here with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. And I'm excited to talk a lot about remote mixing and any other advice that you have within that area. I think a lot of our audience is interested in understanding the difficulties and the successes of having a portable setup, the benefits of having a permanent setup, you know, maybe as well, and what it was like. I'm sure people also want to hear about what it was like moving to Florida. It sounds like in the middle of the pandemic. And then coming back to LA and being back and forth. I mean, it sounds like you've got your hand in a lot of different things going on, but you're doing pretty well in the industry. I've asked a lot of questions. Let's first start off with you're from the Netherlands and you're doing music here in the United States now as a mixer for pop, like radio music. Tell us how that started and briefly that journey.
It's a luck of the draw, I almost say. So my journey started when I was a little kid. So I have two older siblings. And when we were about, I'd say ages six, around that, about that age, our parents put us through music school as an extracurricular activity. So you learn, like, you know, music theory, just the bare basics. Of course, as a kid, you hate it because you want to play outside, play soccer, play basketball, whatever. So you're like, oh, there's all this theory stuff. It's, you know, like, I don't want to do it. Later in life, you're like, oh, I'm very grateful for it because now what I'm doing, I understand the bare essentials as far as music theory goes. So I did that till I think about age 12. And then after age 12, I went to high school. My older brother at some point brought some music software back home, installed it on the family computer with the disclaimer that nobody could touch it. It was his software. So, of course, whenever he would leave the house, I'd be like, what is this? So I'm like, oh, I can compose music with this. So started dabbling in that, started kind of producing music to a degree. I think 2 years later, I started being very hands-on and being like, okay, let me just figure this out more, like what I'm doing. I started sending, because back then the internet was kind of starting up. So we were still printing physical CDs. Sending those burning physical CDs, sending them out to record labels, And I kept doing it very persistently. And eventually there were some interest from some record companies, started doing a bit more of the trance music back then. Got a publishing deal at around 14 years old. And then when it was like about 16, 17, I'd say, my music publisher told me very clearly, okay, you have talent, but your mixes are terrible. Like, we got to figure something out about the sonics and everything. Like, you can hear the talent, but it needs to be stepped up. So I think at that point, I started getting OCD about, okay, how can I get better mixes? Started doing weekend internships at the first local radio station to get some basics of, like, the technology going, you know, the standard, like, broadcast compressor, limiters, how that system works. Eventually, I got introduced to a friend. Through a friend, I got introduced to somebody that ran a live PA company, and he was building studios, recording studios. So he's like, I know you want to do the recording studio part of it, but let's get your hands dirty with some live sound, you know, assistance, so you can kind of get like routine going and you know, figure out it's still audio, what that entails until the recording studios are done. Then I can actually get you here to become an assistant recording engineer. Did that, became eventually the assistant recording engineer. Eventually, I think it was about 18 years old. A studio opened up in Rotterdam, very ambitious. They had one of the very first Neve 88Rs. The entire studio was built, it was in the old Heineken factory in the cellar. The studio was built and designed by, I believe, the New York company Botau, that did a lot of studios back in the day. They still do. Long story short, they put so much money into a studio for, in my opinion, a community and country that doesn't sell music like that. Learned a lot. And they went probably, I think it was within 6 months, they went belly up, because it was just like, it's way too expensive. Through there, met some other people. Eventually, I was like, I need to really get my feet wet in the States, because it's super easy and quick to reach a ceiling in a small country as the Netherlands. So like, in order to grow and really become better, I have to jump ship and literally go across the pond, basically. So I went to America back and forth with a tourist visa. So 90 days US, 90 days back to Europe, 90 days US. In between times, I went to London a few times as well, which was great. That's one of the moments I met Harmony Samuels. And then I met Harmony Samuels again in LA, which was amazing. He's done amazing things ever since. And then eventually you start thinking, okay, I really need to be in LA after having spent time there, seeing how the industry works. And then it was like, okay, let's figure out if we can obtain a work visa. And from there on, the whole thing started snowballing more and more.
Incredible. And when you were in LA, where did you start? Did you just get started immediately, or did you do recording a little bit, or did you just go right into mixing?
No, I was taking any type of gig I could get within audio.
How many years? Well, first off, when did you get a non-tourist visa?
The first one,
was it like years later?
Not that much later. I think it was like 2010.
Okay, so about 3 years. Okay, cool. And so you were here, you're doing whatever gigs you can. Did you know that you wanted to be a mixer before? Or was it something that just... Okay, so you knew. You had a direction, a goal. When you were in LA, especially being from another country, LA kind of feels like it's its own country, even in America. What was that like for you, like from a cultural standpoint? Because I'm sure a lot of listeners have been curious about moving here for their career. What was the culture shock? What was that like?
It was a big one, and it was not a big one, because we get a lot of, you know, US movies on Dutch television shows. You get some way, somehow, some culture in, although it's a fake culture, so to speak, if I can say it that way. But then still, once you land at LAX, the first thing you see is like compared to like growing up in Holland, streets are small. It's, you know, a lot of houses are, you know, two houses under one roof. So like kind of the duplex type situations with the townhouses and everything. And now I have like the big freestanding houses, the extremely wide roads, the freeways that are like eight lanes wide, the cars are way bigger. So it's like, wow, what's going on? Everything is bigger out here compared to Europe. So it was definitely one of those shocks of like, okay, there's a lot of ground to cover on a both career-wise, personal-wise, but also mentally by, you know, embracing everything that you see. So it was definitely a time to adjust and figure things out. Yeah.
Amazing, amazing. So you started mixing and you've been trying to do mixing, but you were doing whatever gigs that you can. Around what year were you able to say no to everything else and just focus in on mixing? How many years did that take?
When I really could focus solely on mixing, that must have been, I'd say about 2014, 2015.
Yeah, 2014, 2015. Yeah. And at that time, was it like a work from home situation, or did you start doing remote then, or did you have like a home studio or like a studio that you call home, or how was it then?
Back then, I worked a lot with other producers. So they either had their own spot or they would rent out like one of the major studios. So a lot of work got done that way. And then eventually 2016, I believe, about 2 years later, a year or 2 years later, I started renting a studio spot. Just an empty studio room, just bring your own equipment type situation. From there on, it grew to a studio house in 2017, which was an idea from a producer I work with a lot, Dem Joints, who's with Dr. Dre, with the whole like camp, the Aftermath camp with Focus and them. So it was kind of created like an incubator with that house. There were some artists living there. We basically turned a lot of the rooms into like studios, whether it be like production rooms or just recording rooms. The garage was turned into his personal production room. And then from there on, eventually I got my own house with a studio in there in one of the spare bedrooms. Still not 100% remote. And then as soon as COVID hit, that's when everything changed. And it was like, okay, we got to figure out how can I address mix notes quickly, efficiently, without us having to go through 20 revisions, because I might turn something up by, let's say, 3 decibels, just to name a number, and the sweet spot might be 1.5 decibels. So you keep going back and forth a lot on minor notes. So as soon as COVID hit, it was trying to figure that out. And then a company named Audio Movers came to the forefront that allowed people to stream directly from their Pro Tools sessions to anybody else in the world. So that completely changed the game as far as remote mixing.
Nice. Are you currently sponsored by Audio Movers?
I am not, although I know Igor, one of the founders, very well. But at the same time, I'm like, the price is so affordable.
Yeah. I think have you like tried 100. Any other alternatives or anything like that? Because I use Audio Movers as well. I'm just curious.
In the beginning, before I got hip to Audio Movers, it was like Zoom. But the problem was the quality was degrading and...
Yeah, shit, dude.
Yeah, it was terrible. The whole experience was absolutely terrible. Like nothing really could get done efficiently. And then on top of that too, which I don't like to share my screen, and then people usually go immediately to the whole thing of like, you don't want to share your secrets. I'm like, I don't have no secrets. The reason why I don't want to share the screen is because then people get too visual. You start looking at what I've done on the session. Hey, what is that? Hey, what is this? Versus I just need you to listen to the mix. Your low for it, if we want, is you have a few minor notes, so I need you to be tuned in with just your single sense of hearing. Get away from the distraction of the visual aspect, how things look, or what might be on there that you are foreign to. So, okay, let's address those notes while I have you on FaceTime. So we still have face-to-face contact visually. You just don't see what the mix looks like, because I don't want you to get distracted.
I feel like you just spilled one of the major secrets. among engineers. Yeah, that's true. I mean, we joke about it, but like part of the reasons why I love mixing and like never meeting the clients is part of it is that like they don't have to see me. They don't have to be like, oh, this guy, I don't like the way he looks, so I don't like his mixes. You know, there's nothing like that. You know, if anything, they're just happy that I bring back the mixes on time, and then they judge me for my business efforts.
Time, it's like, it's either the V1 or some minor nodes that really get quickly adjusted with just the audio streamers move. Like, just give me an hour out of your day and we go through it. Okay, done. Submitted. Oh, this is easy breezy. They don't have to leave wherever their comfort zone is, or they might be on tour. It can get easily done, or they're at a different studio recording new materials. Like, whatever they're doing, we can fit it in that schedule easily without like what we used to do back in the day. You have to show up at the studio. So now it's like you take a bunch of time out of that day just to get some revisions done. And I was like, no, just jump on the phone real quick. Okay, cool. That's it. Done.
Yeah, absolutely. It's people need to be thinking about that sort of stuff. So you were talking about, I wanted to specifically ask you, because we've done many episodes on like different journeys and paths to mixing professionally. Some people assist, you know, find their way with a recording engineer, or if they're able to assist with like under Manny's studio, they go directly to Manny afterwards after a couple of years, or et cetera, et cetera. Some people will just be totally self-supported, self-learn, and then just get lucky in some way or another. And you did another route, which is you stuck with producers, it sounds like, and they just need someone to mix the songs. I mean, they're just pushing exactly. Product. They need someone to mix the songs. And for them, it's a business move. Like, they don't want to have to like extradite all of this mixing process for a premium when they could just have someone that they can watch and like, you know, watch over and be a part of the process. So it makes a lot of sense. And that turned into a mixing career. Can I ask a little bit, and I ask this respectfully, especially with the Triple X, which is in 2021, and we haven't gotten to 2021 yet in your story. We're still about 2017. World record, right? Not just platinum, diamond, or whatever the heck it is right now. It's a world record holder.
We held it.
You held it. Okay, that's right. That's
Mariah Carey with All I Want for Christmas kicked us out, which makes sense.
Really? Oh, okay, yeah. Dang.
I think either Ariana Grande has it now, or it went back to Mariah Carey, because I remember Ariana Grande at some point had it too.
Like, hey, but you got
by
it,
Mariah, I think, and then Mariah got kicked off by Ariana, and then I think it went back to Mariah.
So my question is, was that just like lucky? Did you do anything different? Did you get picked up by management? Like, just a quick heads up for you. Right now, you can grab 4 incredible free plugins over at mixingmusicpodcast.com/babyaudio. These are must-haves and they're totally free, no strings attached. Lou and I have been using Baby Audio forever, and I'm telling you, these plugins are game changers. They've got some killer paid plugins too, like Humanoid, their new vocal transformer and tuner. It's perfect for creating unique vocal effects and hard tuning. And even though I'm not a producer, I know they got some insane synths for the producers out there. For my mixes, I can't live without Tape, both versions of I Heart New York, Comeback Kid, and Parallel Aggressor. These are pretty much in every session that I do, no joke. So don't miss out. Head to mixingmusicpodcast.com/babyaudio, grab those free plugins, and if you want to upgrade, use the code MIXINGMUSIC for 15% off any order. You'll save big and get the tools to make your mixes sound incredible. Again, that's mixingmusicpodcast.com/babyaudio. Now back to the show. How did you go from like moving from Netherlands to like,
it was so random.
Yeah.
Because it was so random. So I did a record for, I don't know if it was ending up in Def Jam with Jovi Rockwell. And one of the producers is Jamaican. He eventually put me on, because he produced Sizzla, the reggae artist. Mm-hmm. So he put me on the album that he produced for him. So I mixed that. And during that time, he because he's Jamaican, he's from Florida, he met Triple X. So his friend that owns a studio up here in Sunrise is where Triple X started out when it was, I think, about 15, 16, when he just started like recording just, you know, the rap songs and kind of getting his feet into the ground of stuff that he wanted to do. And eventually they started working on 17. So the whole thing was, okay, this is great, but he realized that at least the singles needed to sound sonically competitive to whatever was out on, you know, on radio, streaming platforms, but still kind of keep it in the raw element of things. So that's when they brought me on. But originally I just stepped out from the whole situation where I was heavily doing R&B hip hop, and I kind of wanted to get more into like the pop realm of things. So I wasn't really feeling it, and it was SoundCloud. And I remember one of Dre's artists told me at that point, he was like, "You've always played Look at Me," and I was always like, "This is terrible. I don't know what this is, but this is terrible." So when I met him, I was reluctant to begin with, but then when I met him, in the back of my head, it was like, he's a SoundCloud rapper, and I see the face tattoo. So in my head, I was like, this is not going to be anything good. And anyway, he did Look at Me. So I'm like, this is just, you know, your mind automatically goes to like,
yeah, of course,
profile, distorted, bad recorded stuff. Like, I'm not interested. But the way he was persistent, and the way I know how I was in my teenage years being persistent when I was producing music, I felt the need to show him the respect and allow him to press play. Because that's, I'm like, I did that. So it's almost like giving back. In a way, giving back. So he pressed play. I heard Jocelyn Flores. I was floored. I'm like, hold up, that's you. He's like, yeah. I'm like, I gotta be on this. And then he played Fuck Love with Trippy. And I was like, no, I was like, dude, I'm like, don't pay me. I'll do those two for free. Send you your merry way. Did those two. It's funny because I met him on my birthday, July 31st, 2017. I mixed Jocelyn Flores on my birthday. So fast forward August. Actually, it came out on August 25th, 2017. So album came out, great. Didn't pay attention to nothing. Then 2 weeks later, when the Billboard charts published everything, I didn't look at anything. So my mind was like, okay, whatever. You know, I'm just minding my business. And I got like text messages and congratulations, this, that, and the other. And I was like, what are you congratulating me on? And then they're like, look at the Billboard chart. I'm like, what am I looking at? And then they're like, look at Billboard 200. I'm like, okay, I'm looking. They're like, look at number two. I'm like, oh, snap, we're number two with the album. And then he's like, not only that, go to the Hot 100. Okay, go to the Hot 100. Top 30, I think it was at 28, if I'm not mistaken, Jocelyn Flores chart at 28. And from there, it kind of got a snowball effect. After that, I did Denny Lay's debut album, the single, All I Know, with Cass. Did three songs on YBN Amir, YBN Cordae, and YBN Almighty J's album when they were still the YBN Collective. And after that, I did one of the records for Lecrae for All Things Work Together. It just became this whole snowball effect of a lot of stuff. So it was amazing. And then we jumped on. I remember in November that year, Ja called me up and he wanted to do a Ghetto Christmas Carol. And he was like, I want to do this EP. I want to dump it out. Like, I want to do it in one weekend and dump it out on Monday by myself. Did that film project. And then speaking about like, you always as a mixer, you try to be, they make things as perfect, so to speak, as possible. But I'm always like, imperfectly perfect is always one of my sayings. But the funny thing was, I was struggling with the 808 because the 808 was distorted. It was like clipped within the DAW. So I'm asking Ronnie J, the producer, hey, can you do me a favor and just, you know, check your gain structure and bounce out the 808 again. And then he's like, no. He's like, it needs to be like that. It just needs to be more, it needs to be clean, but more lo-fi. And I was like trying to understand it. And he was like, oh, you know what? He's like, it's a white guy. Let me explain it in white guy terms. So he's like, think of the 808 as the electric guitar. And I was like, oh, I got you. All right. I was like, instead of cleaning it up, I got to go the other direction. Because it's interesting, because originally you start thinking of like, okay, you know, I'm going to sound like the shittiest mixer, like for a better word, you know, that's out there. And you're not thinking in terms of the song, the feel, the vibe of like what suits the song. So that's one of the learning processes of like, no, what suits the song? Because sometimes better is not better. It's supposed to be innovating and pushing the envelope.
So at the beginning of this episode, I said I wanted to talk about remote mixing, but I completely changed my mind and I'd rather talk about this. because I think this is a really good point. And you're reminding me with SAD. With anything XXX did, it was fairly controversial because it, from a mixing perspective, it was kind of shitty. Like, you know, I mean, depending on how you look at it.
It was a weird, like, lo-fi thing. It was like, it was the polished, I would say it was the polished lo-fi stuff. Because yeah, even with SAD, yeah, if you listen to SAD, that snare is way too loud, way too sharp. But it worked.
And it's so polarizing, more importantly. People loved it. People hated it. And I find this really interesting within the world of art. With anybody that has good success, they do tend to be polarizing.
You have to.
And it's interesting. Oh, there you go. I mean, even with more pop stream, Billie Eilish's, like, not this last one, but the one before, where it was like, yeah, why is it so dark and like lo-fi sounding? And yet it like, it sounds incredible. More importantly, it like gives the listener an emotion that, like, through mixing, through like, because you don't distort, like, you can distort things through producing and stuff, but that's like kind of a mixing thing, and how much just distorting it and making the snare drum too sharp can make it feel like angsty and like neurotic. You can make it feel something that you couldn't do clean.
No, exactly. And that's when you start looking at history, when you start looking, especially if you study, for instance, Jimmy Iovine, when he started Interscope, and then they pretty much signed everything that was very polarizing. Things that were, you know, out of left field, artists that didn't make any sense, but it was so different from anything else. It was like, let's give it a chance. And I think it's very important with art, because like you said, it's a feeling. If you hate it, then I still did my job right. If you love it, I still did my job right. It doesn't matter. I gave you a feeling. So that means that we are winning.
Yeah. If with art, the worst thing that you can do is to not provoke any feeling.
Yes.
Like if someone leaves, like even with an author, if someone leaves like a really bad review of a book, or like someone just like doesn't leave a review because they don't care enough, you know, like it's like, it's different. Like,
it's I find that.
Yeah.
Put it this way. It's like having a relationship. The person that becomes numb in a relationship, nobody wants that. You either want to have that fight or you want to have the good times. You don't want to have the numb.
Because
like, oh, people are tuned out. It's not gonna do anything. And then even like you said with the bad review, people are gonna read the bad review, and then a lot of times you get enticed, you get interested, you're like, huh, this is such a bad review. Now I wanna read it. Or, oh, this record is so bad, I actually want to listen to it and see for myself how bad it is.
There's a quote that I love. It says, haters turn followers into subscribers. Yeah. So it's like, yeah, like they make rational people think. It's like, wait a second, it's not that bad actually. Let me look at it. And then they're like, oh, this is good, you know? But I wanted to ask you, well, first off, before we talk more about this, I want to ask specific to this situation. It sounds like that in this case, you didn't push back. You didn't say, no, I don't want to do that. But it sounds like most of that distorted sound, that the stuff that you were talking about from a mixed perspective, was being pushed pretty heavily by the artist and the producers. This was their vision. And then you dropped your ego enough to say, yes, let's do it, right? Which is a whole nother conversation.
100%. I always feel it's a creative environment, so ego needs to leave at the door. Doesn't matter which step of the process you're in. I think as long as we can keep the conversation going and stay open-minded, we can do great things. I mean, I've learned so many techniques that I would never, ever think I would do based on, you know, thinking in very clear engineering terms. It's like, why would I do this? Or why would I put this type of processing on whatever element? That makes no sense, theoretically. But then when you do it, you're like, this is a really cool sound. And that can only happen with people that have very minimal or no knowledge about either the mixing aspect or the engineering aspect. So a lot of producers just go by feel and they just like, oh, let me try this on that. Or let me put this on that element. And then technically it's wrong, but it sounds good. So at the end of the day, I'm always like, if it sounds good, it is good. I mean, I've had situations where the way I learned it is I used to be very, very technical. Up until you're in the studio and you're at the board, and then, you know, it's always good to be in a room with people that are smarter than you or have more knowledge than you. So then it's like, okay, technically this is great, but let me just turn, you know, on the SSL EQ, let me just turn the knob, let's dump 18 dB at 5K. Did that sound better or worse? And then when you start thinking in those terms, all of a sudden you start responding on everything with intuition and feel. How did that make you feel? Did that make it feel like it sounded better or worse? Or did this bring out warmth to make it feel like it's embodying you and makes it feel like the record is very homely? Or we creating a more like angsty type record, like let's make it a bit, you know, raw on the elements. And it's all about forget the numbers, go by feel. How do you feel this should sound versus it technically is wrong. Don't care. Does it sound better or does it sound worse? Are you adding or are you subtracting from what it needs to be? And that's all it is.
This is interesting because in retrospect, obviously the song was a hit. But when you were making it, it's important to recognize, especially for our listeners, that you had no idea if this was going to work. Nobody had any idea. It was a huge risk. And a
X
part of you...
X had the idea. Because he FaceTimed me. You know, this is funny. I challenged that guy a lot. Not to cut you short.
Yeah.
But this is a very interesting story. So he was so in tune with everything. The universe, life, everything. He FaceTimes me and he tells me, I got this record. It's going to be a number one record. He sends me Sad. He asked me, he hung up. He's like, listen to it, call me back. Listen to it, call him back. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. I'm like, probably he's going to chart with number one. This is far-fetched. And of course, he was right again.
I think it speaks volumes.
He was always right. He always knew.
Well, and the point that I'm trying to make is, if for anybody that's listening, I mean, this is a common story of like, local engineer or producer, they say, no, your idea is dumb. Let me do it my way. And they tell their clients like, no, I'm right. And here you are, you're thinking, you thought this is crazy. This isn't going to work, but you were open-minded enough to try it anyway.
Yep.
And then that was, because I think, hear me out on this. This is philosophically, I think this is art. The art is important because 90% of artists that are delusional about their craft, they're wrong. 90% of artists aren't going to have, 99% of artists and creatives in whatever modality that they choose, whether it's oil on paint or pottery or something else or music, right? They're not going to make that hit number one song. But you have to be totally delusional. And it's going to be like that 1% of people that like, there's no other way to do this. I'm right. This is going to be number one hit. And it's that 1% of complete risk takers that totally change the game, that change art forever. And I just find that like, even though 99% of artists and creatives are going to be wrong, I still think it's so important for creatives to act like they're in the 1% and to believe in themselves or their team as if they are the 1%. And it's just really interesting because us as the service providers, we become engineers because we're more risk averse. You know, like if we're creative enough to like maybe
or,
like make
or
some
in my
music.
Case, I'm a failed producer. So it's like, let me be cool with great productions that I can't do.
Yeah, I'm, mean, so like it probably statistically, probably, right? This is just totally speculation, but probably engineers are less likely to take risks because we're a little bit more logical, hence why we're engineers.
Yes.
Like at a local level, at the beginner level, I see far too often people saying things like, oh, I don't want to do this anymore. Can you take my name off the record? Oh, this is just demoitis. You're being dumb right now. And they lose the creative aspect of what we do, which is to try new shit. Try shit nobody's ever done before. Even if that pisses you off, at least give it a chance. And then maybe, just maybe, you'll find huge worldwide success just as you did. And I find it really interesting that you could have easily been like, no, he was right. We knew what we were doing. But even now, you're like, it was kind of lucky. Like, we had no idea. And I think that's like really truthful about all this.
It's just the love. I always say you got to do it for the love of really loving what you do. Because else it becomes transactional. And once it becomes transactional, the wrong kind of energy is now attached to the art. So if you come in and you really love what you do, money will follow. But you got to stay focused on the very thing that's the most important, and that is, do you love what you're doing? Because if it's not, just go and find something else. And even to hone in on the whole aspect of the ego thing of, I don't want to do this, or it should be that way. The thing that I always ask every client is to send me their rough mix with anything. I will not start until I have the rough mix. And everything I receive, I don't receive sessions. Because I'm like, sessions make no sense for me because now I have to figure out what you were doing. And then just knowing how my brain works, I'm now going to look at every single plugin that's on the session. And I'm trying to figure out, why did they do this? Why did that happen? And then before you know it, you're already changing what they originally had. So I'm like, no, give me printed stems. And I say stems, not multi-track, because if you have layers of kick drums, to me, that's one kick drum. So send me that as one kick drum. I don't want to change the, you know, level or whatever you had in between that made that nice, you know, group of kicks sound like the kick drum it is. Same with harmony stacks and all of that. Because the first thing that I'm going to get from you is, hey, can you turn the mid harmony up or down? I'm like, if I just had the stereo stem of the harmony group, then we wouldn't have that issue. So that those notes are gone. And coming on that point, it's, to me, it's like, whatever the rough is, I want to just improve on the rough. And that's it. I don't want to change the rough. And I don't want to change it to a way where it now sounds like a completely different record. Or even to the point when you have, every once in a while, you have a client that says, oh, I want it to sound like XYZ. Okay, but you're not XYZ. And it works for XYZ because XYZ is XYZ. It's the identity of the artist. If you have your own identity, you know, because at the end of the day, if I play a piece of music and I look at the artist, I should be able to hear the music and picture the artist's face with that music. Now, if you sound like somebody else, then I'm going to hear the music and my mind is going to picture that artist, not you as the artist. So that's also very, I think, a very big mistake that a lot of them do. That's why I also never ask for what reference tracks do you have that I need to listen to sound like. No, send me the rough. All I care about is the rough. We're going to get the rough and we're going to make the rough better. That's all it is. Because it's your art. It has to be a different sounding, you know, type of music than anything else that's out there because it's uniquely you.
Yeah, I think this is a great point. I wanted to talk about, you spoke about two things, asking the rough and getting stems instead of the session or multi-tracks, in order to force yourself to not change too much, which I love. I want to talk about that. Also, I want to talk about your advice about like, just love what you do. First off, about the rough things, I told a story here on the podcast. One of my bigger artists, I think he's had some like trauma or something before where he's like, he doesn't usually work with mixers. And his management, his A&R hired me out. And I can tell by the way that he sent the session, because he sent me two tracks. He sent me the instrumental and the vocal. And then the A&R's like, basically don't do anything. Just clean it up a little bit. And for me, I find it interesting that the higher the level we go, and even the more that we get paid, the less we do, which makes sense, you know, like, but also it doesn't make sense at all. And I think that that's like important to talk about. You talked about clients have a vision, and even for, I mean, the listeners here, again, they're probably like, they've heard of mixers, or they've heard of local producers and mixers say, give me the dry stems. Don't send me anything wet. And that's not something that professionals do. And in fact, I love the idea that you as a professional actually ask for not just the track outs, but stems, because I don't want to change as much, and I want to start from where you left off. People don't realize that that's like a more professional way of doing things, because YouTube taught people like, no, the professional thing is to let them start from over.
It also makes sense, because as the artist producer, you've worked on that piece of music for maybe months at end. And then if you give me the dry stems, then the first thing you're going to say, no, I like what the riff was, how the riff or the demo was sounding. I get that. Now I have to be magically trying to figure out what you were doing versus send me everything you have. Because I always do it this way. I'm like, send me everything fully wet, bounce through your master bus, just bypass the final limiter, so I at least have some dynamics control on my end. And then with the lead vocals, I'm always like, send me three pairs. Send me the complete dry one just in case, because you never know. Then send me one that's fully EQ'd, tuned, and compressed. And then either send me a full wet one, but I'd rather have you send me the vocal effects such as reverb and delay separate. I have those separate in there, so I don't have to recreate them, because a lot of times they're like, you can do it better. I'm like, I'll do a pass with my effects. And then they're like, I like the effects we had in the demo. I'm like, exactly. So why change it? Because you're so used to that sound. And a lot of times they do certain like different delay throws or special effects on certain words. So it's like, I can kind of hear what you did there, and I can recreate it to a certain extent, but it's not going to sound exactly like you had it, because I don't have that exact chain. So it's better to send me that in that way. And to backtrack a little bit, even with the, when you said with the artist, with the experience that some of them have, where they've had so many bad experiences with mixers, because I always find it surprising that I hear the stories that records come back completely different, and not different in a good way. I even have it with some producers that, you know, the A&R is like, I'm having real difficult time getting the beat stems and this, that, and the other. I don't know what's going on. We've been trying to trace them down. Then I'm like, hey, who's the producer? And they're like, oh, it's so-and-so. Okay. If I know them, I just call them. And then they're like, oh, you're going to mix that one? Oh, dude, thank God. I'm going to send you stems now. Because the problem was, before that, they might have had it sent to somebody that, for whatever reason, did way too much on those beat stems. And the producer that have worked with me know that I need the beat stems just to have the ability to carve space where it needs to be, maybe to widen things up or pan things slightly out of the way so we have a more clearer track. I'm not going to change anything drastically. I mean, I'll always do my parallels for kick and snare, those type of things, just to fatten those up if need be. But other than that, it's very minimal things. I always go by the 80-20 rule. 80% I'm listening, 20% I'm actually doing something. And
that's great.
Even to hone on more on that, there's an app for Apple called Break Time or Break Timer. And mine is set for 20 minutes of work, 2 minutes of rest. So every 20 minutes, every 20 minutes, my screen literally blacks out and it says, take your rest. And it's a timer of 2 minutes. So I can't do anything, can touch anything. So it forces me to stand up, walk around, come back after 2 minutes. And the good thing is, because you gave your ears a break, now you have fresh ears. Because a lot of times we start tweaking and then we lose track because our ears get so used on what we're hearing that we fatigue them too quickly. And then before you know it, everything sounds way too far from what it has to be. Versus, no, let me just step out, come back. Okay, there we go. And to further on that, the way my setup is, I have an army baby face. The reason I have that is because it's super mobile, but also it has programmable buttons. So my interface is always with the dim switch activated. And then people ask why, because I'm like, the dim switch gives me a 74 dB C volume level. And I base that off records that I've done that are like -9 lufs. So I kind of always have a consistent monitor level. So when I load in the stems into my template, it goes automatically to the mix bus. And when I press play, I never have to change my volume knob. I never touch my volume knob. The only thing I do is I press dim to get to take the dim off. So now I have my loud version, which is 85 dB. And then if I listen loud, okay, cool. Then I go back, press the dim. It's back to my normal monitor level. And then the way I judge individual levels of instruments and everything, I mix a lot of mono. So I press the mono switch on my interface and I A-B with the roof. And that's how I easily can figure out where the elements are sitting volume-wise. And then I take the mono button off and then I can hear everything in the stereo width. Because a lot of times when we listen in stereo, there's so much information happening. If you switch it to mono, you can immediately hear, oh, there's one instrument I can barely hear. First thing I do is let me try and pan it.
And then yeah, you can't hide it with panning. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Because then they're like, oh, but you're in mono. You can't pan it. I'm like, yes, you won't hear it in the stereo field, but all of a sudden you hear the instrument pop out. So you're like, oh, it is a pan thing. And then you switch, of course, the mono off because probably you've panned it way too far. And same with EQ strokes. So let's say I'm carving space. I usually go, I carve, and then whatever number I end up on, I usually back it off by, I'd say, 20 or so percent. Because it's always the first instinct is to do it a little too much. So I always back it off slightly a little bit. And it's just like little things that just make it easier to get things done. So,
yeah, that's interesting. You gave tips about 20-minute timer and an app, which is great. People would love to hear that. Mixing a mono for width as well as for frequencies. Because like when things are panned out, it's harder to tell when things are clashing. Right. That makes sense, right? Okay, so I want to go back to another thing. Sorry, we're backtracking here. I'm kind of writing things down as you're saying them. The first thought that I had before we go, I want to talk about just loving it, which I think is important. The thought that I had with trusting the client, my question is, why don't beginner mixers and engineers and like hometown hero producer engineers, why do they have such a hard time allowing the artists to be artists? And I think what's happening is for us, when artists finally come to us, they already have some momentum. Like they've already had some success. So it makes sense that at a local level or like a hobbyist level, the engineer will get prideful and feel like they can get prideful because the engineer themselves might have more credit and might have more success than the new artist. And so it makes sense that. Yeah. So they both feel like they need to prove themselves.
Yeah, it's definitely a combination of two, I think. It's one of those like, I have to prove myself that I'm a great mixer or I'm a great engineer. And therefore, I'm going to superimpose myself on whatever the product is or the record that we're working on so that they can see my value. No understanding Ooh. That you're serving the art. Because it's not about...
That's right.
The value shows when... I would say the value shows when you're technically invisible. Because as a mixer, I'm like, you're not supposed to have a sound. Of course, we all kind of have a sound. But the whole purpose is to serve the artist and the record. And therefore, I need to kind of be incognito and transparent. I need to be like super transparent on it. Like Bruce Lee said, you got to be like water. So just go with the flow. If they want to do this, then do it. Because before you know it, it actually enhances everything.
I love that. I want to repeat that. Like the value, people confuse the value to the craft mixing. But the real value of a mixer is the service. I really love that. And I think that's the confusion of like the local hometown hero, the hobbyist, people that have horror stories with engineers is they don't understand. They think they're doing it for the value. You're paying me a lot of money, so I want to do more for you. But the value is like fucking naming your stems and sending them in time. You know, like...
Literally.
Yeah, like replying so to my emails.
Yes. Being available to make changes.
Yeah, not being visibly pissed off when you want a revision, you know? Like, that's real. That's real. That's,
you have to listen to me.
I think that's really important. And that's like what's kind of keeping people from finding the next level is their inability to correlate that. Exactly right. Like, they think the value is the craft, but you're saying, and I think this is true, this is what I've been saying, you said that very clean, very precise, the value is the service. The thing that I want to talk next about is you said just loving it. There's a you have to love it. And I know we're going back a little bit. The reason why I find this really interesting is that when you said, okay, two things that you said that prove your point here. You said, on your birthday, you got to mix for someone, right? Most people on their birthday, they're like, I want to go out and drink and have fun or whatever. But you're like, I love this so much that I'm genuinely happy that on my birthday, I got to mix for this cool guy, right? And then also, I mean, you said you offered two free sessions. Was it to XXX? Was it to somebody else?
Yeah, or
two
free mixes? I fucked off and Justin Flores for free. Because I he needed, so my thing was, you're technically still a building artist in my eyes. Mm-hmm. So I know that I'd rather have you spend your budget in that case on rolling out the record properly than me taking up that money. I'd rather have you go out there, build something sustainable for you. And then if things pan out successfully, which they did, then of course you're going to have a return client. But on top of that too, now becomes a different story, because now it's like, okay, you know, there's progress, there's growth. Let's see what we're working with now and go from there. Because to me, everything is about building solid relationships. And, you know, sometimes there are situations where you just believe in an artist and you can see where they can go and you just don't want to be in the way of what they're doing. And that same thing goes for, you know, certain artists, because every once in a while I get, a big artist forwarded to me because they went to a couple of other mixers and it didn't pan out. And now they want to try out. They want to, you know, basically have me give it a try. And then I'm always like, okay, before you start wasting more budget, if I believe in the record, I know the artist is a good artist, then I might actually end up saying, you know what, I'll do it as a spec. But if you love me, you know, if you love it and you love me, then you just got to pay the rate. And I mean, obviously, I already know that 9 out of 10 times I'm just going to get the mix anyway. So it's like, no, but just to lower that threshold of like, let's not get everybody in this kind of panic mode of like, but what if it doesn't pan out with him? Then we got to pay another like kill fee and this, that, and the other. It's like, no, I'm fairly sure 99% that I'll nail this mix and you'll be happy and we'll work on many other things together and that's it. But if it really does not pan out, then it's like, okay, something I can't do anything about it, then no love lost. Yeah. You still have money left to like cater to the next mix, basically.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, remind me, at this point when you offered, because free mixes is controversial within our podcast and the Discord and stuff like that. Some people are like, yes, you should do whatever you can to build your career. Some people hate it. Of course, there's a lot of nuance and whatnot. But I want to be clear, when you offered those two free mixes, you were already making a decent amount of money.
Of course.
Yeah. So like, this wasn't like, I need this. This was, you truly loved it.
Yes.
This was selfish. Like, yeah.
And that's a good point. Of course, it's easier said than done if you're in a situation where, you know, rent is coming up, I got all these bills to pay. So it's a lot harder to, you know, be like, I got to get something out of it, which is totally understandable.
And I was thinking more like, if you already make money, then it makes sense if you took the prideful route and be like, no, I'd have to charge you because I don't give anybody discounts because I already do enough. That could have been a valid reasoning too. What's interesting, and I want to ask you this. This is tough because this can go in any direction. There are some mixers, truly, like, and I think I'm one of these people that really, really just love mixing. Not just making music, not just writing, but mixing, right? Engineering. What advice do you have to those that are trying to build a career in mixing and they just can't seem to find that love like you have? What is the next step? What's wrong, or what is the advice?
I don't think anything is wrong. I think a bit more soul searching needs to happen. So if you clearly there's this ambition to do something creative in some extent. So in that case, I would start exploring different aspects of either the creative process or Sometimes it's even where they find out that, hey, it was not actually the mixing thing. It was more being involved in records on maybe a, you know, executive level, where it's like, I'd rather just be, you know, I find great records, great talent, I put them together more as like in an A&R position. Or sometimes it's just like they feel that it's, you know, maybe it is the producer aspect of it. Because it's, to me, it's like if you're not 100% in it, then you got to figure out, okay, there's something there that I definitely enjoy, but I don't know which direction. So in that case, I would start exploring different avenues within the industry. Like, okay, mixing is not really the thing. What else is there that I can try out and see if that's something that I really love, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I think that's really good point. I think it's interesting that among our peers of people that are doing well, they pretty consistently somehow maintained a deep, sincere love for the craft. Maybe not 100%, but pretty close. The second thing is you mentioned about, for some reason, people feel shame. Like, why don't I love mixing? Why don't I love engineering? Like, I'm trying so hard. And they feel like, what's wrong with me? But that's not the point. The point may be exactly like you're right. Like, you actually like being creative, but this is like a backup plan for you and you feel it. And it's like, I don't know.
There's a lot to be. I always tell people there's no plan B.
So then the next question is like, yeah, no plan B, right? No, you have to burn the boats. No plan B. I was going to ask, like, what do you think about... what am I trying to ask? There's something that I'm trying to ask here, something along the lines of, but there's a lot of people that are listening to this podcast that are like really trying to get into it and trying to figure out if mixing is right to them. What do you think people should try or do to figure out if this is right for them?
Oh, that's a really profound question. I think what they could do is, nowadays there's so many available content online. I'm not saying as far as tutorial videos or anything, but you can download multi-tracks to remix. So I'd say a good practice might be to go online, find remix competitions, not to make the remix production-wise, but to download the stems and create your own mix version of records, and see how you feel about that process and dealing with all of that. It's almost like as a kid, you start like cutting up little newspapers and create your little like whatever, like art boards and vision boards, or you start drawing on paper. It's kind of the same experiment where it's like, let me download these multi-tracks, let me load them into my software, and let me just start creating a mix with it and see if it's something I'm thoroughly enjoying. If I'm not, then I have to figure out what it is that I don't enjoy. So it's almost like making a pro and cons list. What do I enjoy about the process? What don't I enjoy about it? And then figuring out, okay, the things that you don't enjoy, are those primarily like technical mix aspects? Or is it more on the creative end, the lack of the creativity, so to speak? And if it's the lack of creativity, then it sounds like you might be better off having a try at maybe production. See how you feel, if that's a better aspect of things. So it's really tough to kind of go through that. It's really, I'd say on a daily basis, it's probably waking up and then making a list of the things you really thoroughly enjoy. And then as you have that pros and cons list, you can kind of start crossing out things with certain jobs, like with engineering. Do you like to be with the artist? Do you like to be in a more diminished capacity as far as creativity goes? So you're more in a less dominant situation. So you got to be more passive. If you enjoy not having to take that lead and have the artist take that lead, and you're just sitting there and, you know, recording the artist basically, or you know, you want to be more dominant in situations, then it's like maybe you're more of the production guide or more of the vocal production person. So I think it's really important to start creating lists of things you enjoy, things you don't enjoy, and then figuring out what each aspect as far as quote-unquote jobs go in the industry and see which ones align the most with your pros list versus your cons list and put those on paper. And I'd say just have a stab at those and figure out which ones are those then you start to really enjoy.
Of course. There's this, this reminds me of the idea of like the secret. I don't believe really in mysticism. Like, I don't believe that like your brain waves creates frequencies or whatever. And you're free to believe that. But I think it's important that like, if you know exactly what you want, then the things that you're willing to do for it will increase. Your resilience will increase. Your hope will increase. And naturally, your day-to-day decisions will change to create that situation for you. That makes sense. I'm like, no, for example, perfect. Like if I don't care to have a house, if I don't care to have a house in LA, then like maybe the way that the shit that I'm willing to eat to make more money, like my resilience goes down. But if I'm like really want to buy a house in LA, then my resilience goes up and I'm willing to do things that most people aren't willing to do in order to make the money to buy a home. Right. So it's anyway.
No, your point. There's a book that even extra read a lot. It's called The Master Key System, which is kind of the precursor to The Secret, which guides you through a 120-day course, which basically tells you the same things. It's about manifestation, but it only works if you firmly believe in, you know, the things that you want to achieve, which is
that
like
book
you
is
said.
Called The Master Key?
The Master Key System. So it's like you said, it's your whole focal point and energy changes because you now have an objective to achieve, but you have to firmly believe in that you're going to get it. So it's basically, I already have what I want. So now my everything around me changes. Like you said, you're going to act different. You're going to look at things different. You're going to make sure that you're going to some way or somehow achieve what you want to, you know, want to become or what you want to do or whatsoever.
Okay. I'm a huge fan and I'm a big believer that everything that you could ever want to learn is hidden in plain sight in books. I'm a big believer of this. This is something we talk about all the time on the show. And it's so great that someone like XXX, the PR, he doesn't come off as a book reader. That's not something that you think of when you see XXX. But I mean, he was reading this book. It's like, read, dude. There's a joke that I love of a comedian. He says, Americans are willing to die for their country. How about you read a book for your country?
It's so true. It's so true. I think speaking about books and journeys and what you just had told about how does somebody figure out what they want to do if they don't thoroughly enjoy, for instance, mixing, I think The Alchemist is another good book. I think the message of The Alchemist to follow your omens, like you said, in plain sight, that will guide them more into being more aware and awakened to, what am I really here for?
Yeah. The only time that I've ever second guessed my career choice, the only time that I've been like, should I have been a mixer, is when things were happening outside of mixing. It was like money related things or relationship related things. And it was never the mixing thing. Do I like mixing was never even something that I questioned. It's really interesting. There's one more question that I want to ask you before we start to close here. And again, this podcast is about helping engineers, creative producers make a business full time. I want to tell the audience that I think the audience and I, we can all agree that Cohen, you are incredibly chill. There has been no sensation, which I hate to say that I do feel sometimes from other engineers. There's no sensation of pride. Like you admitted when you're like, it was kind of like random, lucky. I just trusted my gut. It was fun. I really just love this. It's very down to earth. And I'm sure that part of you, I'm sure that you've noticed that that's what makes you stand out as an engineer. And so my question to you is, you're obviously skilled alongside chill. Skill or chill, which one makes you more money?
Definitely skill.
okay, fuck, okay. All right.
then again, we also have Rick Rubin, who's very chill and technically doesn't do anything. But makes it funny.
I think what I was trying to dive at is like, would you, do you think that you would have gotten the opportunities that you got to prove your skill if you weren't chill?
No, because then you get the whole thing of like, that person I don't want to deal with because it's a difficult personality. Mm. And I'm really just going with the flow. It's like, it's your record. Whenever the record plays, nobody's going to be like, oh, that's what Cohen mixed. That's shitty. It's like, no, it's whatever the artist is. And it's like, it's your name. It's not my name. So it's your art. You created it. You picked the beat or even co-produced the beat. You wrote or co-wrote the lyrics. You sang the thing. Who am I to say that whatever that vision is that you have is the wrong vision?
Yeah.
So to me, it's like, try it.
And what I don't want to do, I don't want to minimize skill. That's not like the point of what I'm trying to say.
Right.
Because like, obviously, skill is super important. And I never want to say it's not. Do you find, okay, let's talk about producers, because you're an engineer. At producers at a high level, how often do you, like, genuinely, and I'm being serious, I'm not asking you to prove a point here, how many of the super high-level producers that are consistently doing well financially, how many of them are not chill?
That's a really good question.
10%, 50%, most of them?
It's a very high number of chill producers. Because really? I think we're all here to achieve the same end goal. Because you're all trying to make sure that the artist gets the best possible product. So I think there's a thing, but like you said, it's like, okay, skill is very important, but it's personality is another one. That's why it's also, everything is 80-20. So even business, it's the music business. So your skill is very important, but being easy to deal with, being a good person, being, positive about when you come into a situation, especially energy-wise, because creative situations are very fragile. And you can throw that off by literally the slightest, negativity that you come into. So it's always like, okay, I'm here. Let me figure out what the artist wants to do. What's their vision, what they're working on. And let me see how I can extend and help them achieve that. So I think, yeah, it's, of course, you're going to have the occasional a-hole in that group, but it's so little.
I think that's really important. And part of the reason why I think that's important that you brought up is because for some reason, and this is very common, the dissonance that people feel, they want to be successful and they want to be wealthy, but they feel like they need to be an asshole to get there. Right? So they're like, I want to be really hyper-successful, but I don't want to even consider myself to be a part of the assholes. So they like don't allow themselves to seek success or to do more because that distance. So I think it's hopeful to remind people that like, no, the people that are doing well, like most of them aren't assholes and you don't have to be an asshole to do well.
Let the assholes be the managers and attorneys that just can talk that language to one and another. Be creative and be creative.
Yeah, it's like I always like I don't know how serious I am with this, but I always say like hating rich people is just manifesting poverty because you'll never allow yourself to be.
No, 100% is, because I'm like, I always say what consumes your mind controls your life. So if you're constantly hating and putting that energy out there of like, oh, this person has a bigger car or a more expensive car than I do. They have more money. They have a bigger house. This, that, or the other. You have more success. And like, you can't hate on people because what's happening is you're isolating yourself now to a point where you're not going to be able to function properly because it's the wrong type of energy. And I always tell people, everybody has their time. So I cannot hate on the next person of like, oh my God, why does he have more success than I have? Or why did he get that artist or that record and I didn't? I'm like, because it wasn't meant to be for me. That was meant for them. And, I'll get my things that they don't have and vice versa. So it's all a unity thing where it's like, be happy for the next person because you're also going to be the next person. So
yeah,
it's true.
That's actually really, really amazing. And I'm going to take a step back. You said this, but in different words. And I think this is from a book that I'm reading currently, and I love this quote. While it is true that the arts employ what to us are highly difficult technical disciplines, it is always recognized that they are instrumental and secondary, and that superior work has the quality of an accident. I mean, even with, and we keep going back to the success. I mean, you have so many other records that are way more successful than this. And just to remind people that like don't know, Cohen, you've worked with a lot of modern trap rap artists, as well as some pop stuff, including names like Trippie Redd, Kanye, Sway Lee, Lil Wayne, Maluma, et cetera, so many more. Like, we keep talking about this one record because it is pretty iconic. But I don't want to reduce you down to that one record. You're significantly more than that. But I think for this record specifically, you kind of described that. You allowed this free-forming idea. There's so many moving pieces. His manifestation, his true delusion belief, and then you allowing his belief to blossom, and then it was kind of an accident. Like, it wasn't supposed to be.
There's an accident in the record too.
Oh, really? For real?
There's no second verse. It's empty. So the accident happened. I accidentally, when I created the vocal delay bus, I accidentally had the delay time. I don't know how it happened, but it was set to infinity. So when the second verse comes, the last word of the hook echoes out for infinity through that entire
second. That wasn't on purpose.
No, that was a happy accident.
For real? Wow. Yes. Incredible. Then, yeah, I think you prove that quote just so beautifully.
That sounds like, yep.
There's do you know Leslie Brathwaite? He's another mixer.
Yes.
He's out in Atlanta. He I'm no expert in AI, but I mean, if this quote is true, he asked the question, will AI and computers ever learn when is the right time to make a mistake?
Ooh, that's very profound.
Yeah, like that was his question. I find that really interesting. There is no statistical way to make a mistake. There is no, like, now's the right time.
Rhythmic learning, it's like they all go by learning models. That's what I think a lot of people mistake with AI. They think it's this magical thing. I'm like, it's continuously learning what gets inputted to them. It's like how we learn as kids throughout our entire life. That's what AI does. So indeed, it's like, okay, so what if, because those are all if statements, what if it just somehow starts learning the wrong type of information logarithmically, then it starts being embrained in it, and then it starts outputting that error without realizing it's an error, because there are checks and balances, of course, for systems like that, but it is a good question, because you don't know when. It's like hard drives. Let's say you have a RAID system and you have I believe it's a RAID 1, your hard drive starts failing, creating errors. Now, because it's mirroring on a RAID 1 system, the older hard drive takes it over without realizing that there's mistakes. So now it thinks that it's doing what it's supposed to do instead of having a RAID 5 that goes, wait a minute, that's a mistake on that hard drive. So let me just pause right
what
here.
What a nerdy ass metaphor for engineers, but, which is a reminder, if you've got an old ass 5,000 RPM hard drive, it's time to get a new one.
Yes. Please do. I always get freaked out when people pull up with those old HD. I'm like, oh no, not the needle type on the disc. No.
Yeah. See, I'm Okinawan. So like I'm in a blue zone. And so, like, people pull up with hard drives older than my great-grandpa, you know? I'm like, yo, it's time to get a new one.
That's why I always look at people with their backups. I'm like, wait, you put it on a hard drive from back in the day? I'm like, dude, it's better to get those DVDs. I forgot who makes them. They can last 120 years, I believe. So I'm like,
oh,
the hard drive is not going to last that long. Like...
Yeah, back up your hard drives, get new ones at least once a year, minimum. Anyway, yep. that's a great practical advice too. Cohen, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Honestly, we don't do a lot of interviews, and it's pleasantly surprised how easy you are to talk to, how insightful you are, the practical advice that I think we can all relate to. There's things that I've learned that I'm going to take home and think about more as well. Tell people where they can find you online.
Very simple. I'm very socially antisocial. So it's Instagram at Mixed by Cohen Helens. And then I just redirected. I used to have a full-fledged website, and then we figured out, like, with Jackstar, it's the same thing. So I'm like, why build and keep maintaining a full-fledged website when Jackstar auto-updates the credits and the certifications and all of that? So Mixed by Cohen Helens.com just redirects to the Jackstar one sheet. And then through the Jackstar one sheet, there's also an Instagram link, and that's it. There's no Facebook, there's no Twitter, just Instagram.
And if people ever want to hit you up for a mix or something like that, they just hit up Stent Music Group?
Yes, sir.
All right. And how long have you been with Stent Music Group?
I started with Stent back in, we're coming up on a year now.
Congratulations on that.
Yeah. Thank you.
Congratulations on that. So if you ever want to hit him up, make sure to hit up his management, stentmusicgroup.com, I assume is the website there. Thank you so much, Cohen. I appreciate your time. I hope you have a wonderful day and a good luck on your trip as you move back to Los Angeles in October.
You too. Thank you so much. Yeah, definitely have to come by and visit.
Of course, of course. And on that note, happy mixing, my friends, and stay saucy.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.